Thank you, everyone, for joining this afternoon's telephonic press conference. My name is Angela Kelly, and I'm the Vice President for Immigration Policy at the Center for American Progress here in Washington, D.C. Today we'll be providing important perspectives on the Department of Justice lawsuit that was filed today. As we know today, the Justice Department took a strong stand against Arizona's radical Show Your Papers law by filing a lawsuit. The law reflects certainly an understandable frustration with our nation's broken immigration system, but unfortunately Arizona's effort to assuage the frustration of their citizens has simply resulted in a law that's ineffective, counterproductive, and will likely be found to be unconstitutional. Here to discuss the implications of today's lawsuit from different perspectives, from that of a legal scholar, a litigator, and two experts from the law enforcement community, we have a terrific panel. And first to start us off is Professor Gabriel Chin. Professor Chin is the Chester H. Smith Professor of Law at the University of Arizona's Rogers College of Law, and he's an independent legal analyst who, like the other speakers, will be giving his perspectives on the lawsuit. Professor Chin.
Thank you. So the basic background principle of constitutional law here is that states don't have independent authority to make immigration law. This comes from a pair of cases from the 1870s where California and New York tried to exclude undesirable aliens, and the Supreme Court said that they just can't. This is an area where states cannot set policy for reasons of national uniformity and the connection of foreign policy and immigration. So the important thing to note about SB 1070 is that it's clearly a regulation of immigration law. Section 1 of SB 1070 makes crystal clear that it is establishing a state policy of attrition through enforcement, that it's designed to discourage and deter the unlawful entry and presence of aliens and economic activity by persons unlawfully present. So the text of the law itself makes clear that Arizona is trying to regulate immigration, which demands some sort of legal justification. And the theory of the drafters and supporters of SB 1070 is that it's constitutional, notwithstanding the general prohibition of state regulation of immigration, because SB 1070 mirrors federal policy. The argument is that SB 1070 is just helping to carry out federal policy, so it's okay. This argument is factually incorrect for a couple of reasons, and these are my reasons, but coincidentally or not, they're the same, basically, as the reasons of the Department of Justice, and they're the same, basically, as the reasons articulated by the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. The first problem is that SB 1070 creates three new Arizona immigration crimes and amends one that has been on the books for a while, and none of these crimes, in fact, mirror federal policy. Arizona Revised Statute 13-2928C is a new crime, making it illegal under Arizona law for undocumented people to work in the United States. But Congress determined not to make that a federal crime at all, so Arizona obviously is not carrying out federal policy by criminalizing something that the United States decided not to criminalize. Arizona Revised Statute 13-2319 criminalizes transporting undocumented aliens, but unlike the federal provision, the analogous federal provision, it doesn't require that the transportation be across the U.S. border or in furtherance of their unlawful presence. And it also targets individual non-citizens, not smugglers. So the coverage is very different from that of the federal law. Another provision criminalizing transportation of undocumented aliens, 13-2929 of the Arizona Revised Statutes, uses different language from the federal law. It has exceptions which are not in the federal law, and it doesn't include exceptions which are in the federal law. So one major problem, is that the Arizona statutes do not, in fact, match up with federal law or policy. The bigger problem is that the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is the main federal statute regulating immigration, has criminal provisions, some of which are somewhat similar to the Arizona law, but it also has civil enforcement provisions and relief provisions, which are entirely absent from Arizona law. Arizona's law has one response to finding an undocumented person in the United States, and that's criminal prosecution. The federal law has several possible responses. Criminal prosecution is one, but also civil deportation or some kind of temporary or permanent relief for humanitarian or other reasons. Under the Immigration and Nationality Act, there are ways for undocumented people to avoid deportation temporarily or to be allowed to stay in the United States permanently. And federal authorities decide what should happen to the person based on the facts and circumstances. And sometimes they conclude that criminal prosecution is appropriate, but other times not. So the bottom line is, the way the Arizona law works is that it provides for prosecution and incarceration of someone who, under the federal regime, might have been allowed to stay for foreign policy reasons or humanitarian policy reasons under the decisions, the discretion of the federal authorities. Something that's quite interesting about the federal lawsuit is that they do not question the many ways that Arizona and other states can already work with the federal government to enforce immigration law. The federal lawsuit against the state of Arizona doesn't challenge those many connections. One of them is the 287G program, where state and local officers are trained and empowered to enforce immigration law under federal supervision. The other is the longstanding authority that state and local law enforcement officers have had to arrest for federal immigration crimes. So they can arrest non-citizens who commit federal immigration crimes and turn them over to federal authorities. There's also a program of information sharing where local law enforcement officers who develop suspicion that someone is a non-citizen, they can report that to the federal authorities, who can intervene if they choose. And what these programs have in common is that federal authorities make the determination, they make the policy judgment, the discretionary judgment of what should happen to the undocumented person who has been stopped by local authorities. And SB 1070 does not have that quality. So SB 1070 is immensely complicated and interesting, and there's much more to say about it, but I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Professor Chin. That was very helpful. Our next speaker is Lucas Gutentag. Lucas is with the ACLU's Immigrant Rights Project. He is the director. And also, very importantly, Lucas is the lead counsel in a lawsuit that's challenging SB 1070. It's a lawsuit that's been filed not only by the ACLU, but by MALDEF, the National Immigration Law Center, the NAACP, and the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, and other organizations, including some pro bono law firms. Lucas, your perspective as a litigator.
Thank you very much. I'm Lucas Gutentag. I'm one of the lead counsel in the case brought on behalf of the organizations and entities that Angie just mentioned. We applaud the Obama administration Justice Department for taking this critical step to negate Arizona's unconstitutional usurpation of federal authority and Arizona's invitation to engage in racial profiling. The Justice Department's lawsuit is an unmistakable cannon shot across the bow of other states or municipal entities that might be tempted to follow Arizona's misguided approach. We will continue to aggressively pursue our coalition legal challenge to Arizona's SB 1070, and we welcome the Justice Department's participation in this battle to preserve American values of fairness and equality. The Justice Department's intervention, filing of a lawsuit, demonstrates that this is the most extreme and dangerous of all the recent state and local laws purporting to deal with immigration issues. The enactment of SB 1070 has triggered outrage and opposition from virtually every segment of society, and the breadth of our lawsuit, as well as the filing now by the Justice Department, demonstrates that widespread revulsion. SB 1070 turns "Show me your papers" into the Arizona state motto, and racial profiling into an Arizona obligation. The Justice Department's lawsuit underscores the core claim in the coalition lawsuit that Arizona's law is in violation of federal immigration law, that it directly conflicts and impedes federal immigration priorities and enforcement, and will inevitably lead to racial profiling. In our lawsuit, among the declarations demonstrating the interference with federal authority are declarations by former INS commissioners and by commissioner and by former INS general counsel, which detail with specifics the ways in which SB 1070 would interfere with federal priorities, rely on outmoded federal statutes, and engage in state enforcement of matters that must be in the exclusive domain of the federal government. Our lawsuit was originally filed on May 17th, and we have filed for a preliminary injunction to prohibit the law from going into effect. Briefing on that preliminary injunction is currently underway, as is Arizona's response to the filing of the lawsuit and its motion to dismiss the claims that we have brought. The preliminary injunction hearing is currently scheduled for federal court in Phoenix on July 22nd. The law is scheduled to go into effect on July 29th, so we will be asking the court to prohibit the law from going into effect. The basis, there are numerous claims in our lawsuit challenging SB 1070. The grounds on which we are seeking to have it preliminarily enjoined until its constitutionality can be fully adjudicated are the preemption and supremacy clause grounds that are raised in the Department of Justice lawsuit, and the Justice Department lawsuit obviously underscores the force of those arguments because the administration has now directly asserted that SB 1070 is in violation of federal law and interferes with federal priorities. We have also raised a First Amendment claim and a right to travel claim on the in our preliminary injunction. All of these lawsuits, as well as the earlier filing by the Solicitor General in the Supreme Court on an earlier law, as well as the Supreme Court's granting of review of the earlier decision in which the Ninth Circuit upheld an earlier law and which will now be revisited by the Supreme Court. All of this demonstrates that the force both of the Justice Department and of the courts is that these efforts by states and localities to engage in their own immigration policy and legislation are unconstitutional, and that whatever the frustrations might be with federal immigration policy, these measures are not permitted, and we will continue to ask the courts to enjoin them. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Lucas. Our final two speakers bring an important perspective, one that's also reflected in the lawsuit. It's noteworthy that in the DOJ lawsuit that they have declarations that have been filed from the chiefs of police of Phoenix and Tucson. And on the call today, we are joined by the chiefs of police of Salt Lake City and San Francisco. Our next speaker is Chief Chris Burbank. He is with the Salt Lake City, Utah Police Department.
Thank you very much. I think it's important to note as we look at regulations and laws being enacted that it was barely a generation ago that law enforcement, local law enforcement, was tasked with segregating high schools and keeping drinking fountains separate. And here again, we are alienating or marginalizing a segment of our population and saying that you are not entitled to the same sort of protection under the law that any other member of our community is. And why I say that is the simple fact is that when you look at status in the United States, citizenship, that is not behavioral-based. That is strictly status. And when you talk about reasonable suspicion, probable cause, that those items in the law are based on behavior. And we teach law enforcement officers to profile criminal behavior, to look at the behavior of an individual, and if that meets the criteria of the law for criminal activity, then appropriately a law enforcement officer should intervene and engage in a discussion, if not more, with that individual. But when you start talking about status or citizenship in the United States, that cannot be based on anything other than race or ethnicity. And when police officers are making decisions on those, that is wrong on many different levels, but constitutes biased policing, racial profiling, that is prohibited by the Constitution of the United States. We function best as a police entity, as police departments across the country when we are, in fact, a part of the communities that we serve, not when we stand apart from them. Community policing has worked over the years. We have been extremely successful at reducing crime in the neighborhoods throughout the United States, including Arizona, including Salt Lake City, where local legislatures are claiming that criminals are flooding across the borders into Salt Lake City because it's a sanctuary city for individuals. Well, we have seen a dramatic decrease in the amount of crime, especially violent crime, that's occurring in Salt Lake City. So these claims fly in the face of what actual statistics show. It is important to note that chiefs of police from across the country, not just in one isolated location. This is not a regional thing. This is not a statewide thing. This is across the nation. Chiefs of police have stood up and said, we believe that this is counterproductive to the mission of policing, of local law enforcement. It detracts from our ability to interact with community members and ultimately will cause crime to increase as a lack of community trust exists or furthers itself, we are unable to get basic information. Time and time again, you have police chiefs who stand up and say, there are individuals that are being victimized in my community and are afraid to come forward and talk to the police because of their personal status or the status of relatives or friends that might or might not be involved in an investigation. Anytime, again, that we marginalize a segment of our community and say that we are not going to provide equal protection, that is wrong, and we should stand as police chiefs, as guardians of the Constitution of the United States, and say so. I am very pleased with the fact that the Department of Justice, that the administration has chosen to act and to act swiftly, because laws mirroring Arizona, in fact, local legislatures here in the state of Utah said, we are going to have a better law than Arizona. It's going to be more restrictive, and we're going to deal with the problem even better than they are in Arizona. Something needs to be done, and the urgency of this matter cannot be understated, because we have individuals in our communities right now that have a fear, a mistrust of local law enforcement, and that leads to victimization and more criminals on the streets that we, in essence, are responsible for. And so, again, I applaud that, and I look forward to the future, because there needs to be discussion. There is frustration amongst law enforcement. But when you look at a young police officer in the face, this is what my expectation, for you to go out and enforce the law fairly amongst every member of our community. We cannot do that if we have laws that interfere with that. So with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Burbank. Our final speaker is Chief George Gascon. He is the Chief of Police from the San Francisco Police Department in San Francisco, California. Chief Gascon.
Thank you, Angie, and obviously I agree with what has been said by the prior speakers, and I don't want to repeat myself. I think Chris Burbank very articulate talked about the concerns having to do with community policing. I'd like to bring it to a different level, and that is, one, having been a chief of police in Arizona for 3 years, from 2006 through 2009 in Mesa, Arizona, and having a community where we experienced nearly a 30% reduction in Part 1 crimes during the time that I was the chief of police there, and where we made it a point to focus on crime as opposed to dealing with immigration issues, and being surrounded by county islands that were policed by the Maricopa County Sheriff Department, where the organization made immigration enforcement their primary or one of their primary functions, and seeing side-by-side communities that were demographically very, very similar, and yet in Mesa, crime was going down while violent crime and property crime were going up in those pockets that were being policed by the Maricopa Sheriff Department. And this goes to the heart of this legislation and the problems that I see with SB 1070. In addition to the community policing issues, and the fact that we're going to create a wedge where victims are going to be much more reluctant to talk to the police, including victims of domestic violence and others, in creating a vacuum where criminal elements are going to increasingly take over some neighborhoods, I see a real problem with resources. SB 1070 is going to create a tremendous difficulty for police departments in Arizona to do their primary mission of public safety, because they're going to be tied up doing a great deal of immigration work. this comes at a time where most police departments around Arizona, as well as the rest of the nation, are being reduced in resources. In fact, my own former police department in Mesa, which is the third largest city in the state, has been significantly reduced in terms of overall resources. So this is going to have a very, very negative impact on police resources that should be allocated to fighting crime. And where we already have an example, an Arizona example, of two agencies side by side, one focusing on criminal activity other than the unauthorized crossing of the border, another one focusing greatly on the whole issue of immigration, one having tremendous reductions in crime, the other one having the opposite result. I think also from a legal stance, and now talking as a practitioner, not as a lawyer, this is going to be extremely difficult for police officers to follow without violating the law. 1070 in the way that is written is going to create a tremendous difficult situation for police officers, because it will be very difficult not to use race as a predictor of bad behavior. And as Chris Burbank indicated earlier, we're trained to deal with behavior, not with status. You're going to see officers that are going to be pushed into increasingly using race and certain physical characteristics as a predictor of bad behavior as opposed to a descriptor of a criminal event. And that is going to create a situation where I believe that well-intending, hard-working police officers are going to cross the line. The other problem is that because the law itself is punitive against police departments, because if there is a perception that the officers are not doing their job, anyone in the community may have standing to sue that police department for perceived failure to enforce the law. That is going to create tremendous pressure, both administratively as well as operationally, for police departments. And again, that's going to go to the issue of resources. So I think that in addition to the problems that we have talked about, I think operationally this is going to be a very difficult statute for police departments to follow, to do so constitutionally, and I think it's going to have a very negative impact in the overall public safety of many of our communities.
Thank you very much, Chief Gascon. Operator, could you please give participants information on how they can queue up for a question?
Absolutely. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Paul Davenport.
Hi, this is Paul Davenport with AP. I wonder if the chiefs can address the apparent disconnect between the chiefs and the rank-and-file officers. As you probably know, the two largest police associations representing officers in Arizona support and lobbied for this legislation. What's the disconnect there, where they think it's something they need and you folks think it's dangerous?
Well, you know what? Let me jump in, and this is George Gascon. Having been there, I am not so sure that there is a tremendous disconnect between the chiefs of police in the rank and file. I think that what you're seeing is a disconnect between some of the union leadership and the chief of police in this area. I can tell you that when I was in Mesa, and I had two unions there, I had a chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police as well as the Mesa Police Association, which is part of the Arizona Police Officer Association. I have full support by the majority of the rank and file and by the union leadership. What you're seeing here is you're seeing a very nuanced process that started about a year and a half ago as the leadership of the Phoenix Police Department's Police Officers Union was taken over by different individuals, and then their association with the senator that is leading this charge, as well as the Maricopa County Sheriff. I know that doesn't become evident in the discussion here, but I would be careful to say that this is a tremendous divide between police management and police officers. I think it's more of a union, an individually driven unions and police management in this area.
Chief Burbank, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I'm very comfortable with how Chief Gascon answered the question, and so I'm good unless he'd like something further.
If not, why don't we go on to the next question?
Your next question comes from the line of Elizabeth Ziegler.
Hi, Chief Burbank. Elizabeth Ziegler, KCPW here. I wanted to ask you if you could specifically react to state lawmakers here continuing today even to say that they still intend to introduce a similar law this next legislative session despite the lawsuit.
Well, I think this just speaks to the continual disconnect that has gone on. 4 years ago, the major city chiefs, this is the 60 largest agencies throughout the country, put forth a white paper that said local law enforcement should not be engaged in immigration enforcement, and has stood by that ever since. I mean, this is in the face of all the laws and across the country, not just in Arizona and Utah. And it has continually been a process to where local law enforcement, the advisement, the direction, has not been followed. I mean, we have been very consistent in what the message has been. It is not our role, and it hampers our ability to interact with our community members, and ultimately will increase crime. That message has not changed ever since then. And so I, quite frankly, am not surprised by that fact, because I fully anticipated that members in our state will go forward. But I think it's a very clear message is being sent that the Department of Justice does not believe that this is constitutional for many different reasons, but one of those is because of the mistreatment that potentially could occur with not only undocumented individuals, but citizens of the United States just because of the color of their skin. And I think that message continually needs to be repeated both in Arizona, Utah, and throughout the country.
Thank you.
All right, next question, operator.
Your next question comes from the line of Gloria Goodale.
Hi, this is Gloria Goodale from the Christian Science Monitor. Most observers expect this federal lawsuit to be successful, so I'm just wondering, since obviously the frustrations and underlying concerns that led to this and other local laws, what you expect to happen next, and what you hope will be in effect to address those frustrations and concerns.
Do you mean what will happen next from a litigation standpoint or from a legislative standpoint?
From a legislative standpoint. And yeah, I mean, both politically and legally to address those concerns that led to lawmakers feeling that they had to take these actions. If those efforts get shut down by this federal lawsuit, clearly those communities are still upset, concerned. So where do you see meaningful action coming from, and what would you like it to be?
So this is Angie with the Center for American Progress, and I can take a crack at that just because I've been following the legislative debate for years on this issue. And, you know, it really does feel like a pot that's boiling and is just going to continue to boil over until Congress gets its hand on the controls and turns down the temperature and actually enacts smart legislation. And look, this is an issue that there's no one who thinks that our system is functioning today. There is clear agreement across the board, both political parties, both chambers, it's a broken system. And efforts, you know, nearly 3 years ago to the day to solve this broken immigration system through a comprehensive reform bill failed on the Senate floor. And there's been nothing done but just a passing back and forth, like this is some kind of sort of a hot potato with nobody willing to take responsibility for solving what is admittedly a tough problem. I think there were high expectations when the Obama administration came in that this would be one of the issues that he would take on, and the issue got bogged down and was like in a line of traffic waiting behind health care, waiting behind financial reg reform, waiting behind the energy bill. Lawmakers in Congress have introduced an outline. We've seen Senate Democrats stand up and do that much, but we haven't seen legislation forthcoming. And Republicans, who once stood shoulder to shoulder with Democrats arguing for comprehensive reform, are now calling for the deportation of undocumented immigrants and for more piling on at the border. So there's no one who's blameless in terms of this issue not moving forward. I mean, I think leaders from both parties and in both the White House and on Capitol Hill have got to stop the partisan bickering and begin to do policy making and solve the problem. It's difficult to see that happening this year because the legislative calendar is short. On the other hand, we know that there's a, for the lack of action on policy, that there's also a political price to be paid, and that the Latino community, that's the fastest growing voting bloc in the U.S., is watching this issue carefully. So it's not a matter of if immigration reform is going to happen, it's a matter of when. Hard to see it happen before the midterms. But I think, you know, as we go into the 112th Congress and all eyes are going to be on the 2012 presidential election, it's hard to see how this issue isn't resolved. But we may have to wait for a bit. I don't know if any of the other speakers want to jump in on that. All right, why don't we take the next question if that one was answered?
Your next question comes from the line of Sean Higgins from Investors Business Daily.
I'm afraid the lady with Christian Science Monitor asked pretty much the question I was going to ask, so you can go ahead to the next person.
All right, thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of William Fisher from Interpress News.
Yes, can you tell me if any of the statements that have been made are going to appear online?
We didn't contemplate that when we did this event, so I don't believe so, unless the speakers happen to have their own statements. We have our statement, which is available on our website, and I can see about getting an audio of this telephonic and making that available. But I don't know. Other speakers, do you have your statements available?
This is Lucas Gutentag from the ACLU. Not the complete statement, but there are statements in responding to the filing of the Justice Department suit by the coalition legal team that's available at ACLU.org.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you can get statements from each of the lead lawyers in the case there.
Thank you very much.
All right, and I did just get a note from a colleague saying that we will have audio on the web available after this event. I'm not sure what the time delay will be on it.
Your next question.
And that'll be on the CAPS website, which is the Center for American Progress website, AmericanProgress.org. Sorry, operator, didn't mean to cut you off.
That's okay. Your next question comes from the line of Daisy Hernandez from Colorline.
Thanks so much. In regards to the ICE programs like 287G, do you expect that those are going to be increased or decreased or change in any way as a result of this lawsuit?
This is Lucas Gutentag. I don't think there's going to be any direct effect on 287G agreements. I think they raise a whole host of separate and distinct issues, and there may be a variety of views both on this call and among others on the efficacy and the wisdom of 287G agreements, but they're not directly at issue here. And the one thing I would point out is that the under 287G, police enforcement of immigration laws by local police agencies is under the explicit direction and authority and supervision of the federal government and requires extensive training and reporting and other measures. And that's very different than what SB 1070 purports to authorize, which essentially allows a go-it-alone mandate to local police departments in Arizona. So as much as at least we and some others are concerned about 287G, SB 1070 is, you know, magnitudes worse in terms of both what it allows and, as the chiefs pointed out, what it compels police departments to do because of the threat of lawsuits against police departments by individuals in Arizona who would try to compel enforcement of SB 1070.
Great. Operator, do we have another question?
Your next question comes from the line of Paul Davenport from the Associated Press.
Paul, you're back.
Yes, I am. Lucas, got one for you. Could you talk about the timing of this federal lawsuit so far behind your lawsuit and the others, and whether the feds, in effect, will have a voice in federal court going forward before the July 29 implementation date? You already referenced your preliminary injunction hearing.
Right. Yes, I'm happy to try to address that, although it's obviously up to the court to decide how it plans to schedule these matters. I would assume, but I don't know, that the Justice Department's lawsuit would be heard by the same judge that is hearing the other cases that have been filed against SB 1070. All the cases that have been filed so far have been assigned now to a judge in Phoenix, Judge Susan Bolton, and she has scheduled the preliminary injunction hearing in our case for July 22nd. I would expect there to be some kind of coordination with the federal lawsuit as well. They filed for a preliminary injunction as part of the complaint. So they have taken the initial step asking the court to enjoin SB 1070 before it can go into effect on the 29th. That was part of the filing the Justice Department submitted today. I would expect that the court would issue some kind of a scheduling order, and after the state has an opportunity to indicate its views, so that all of these matters can be heard before the 29th in some coordinated fashion by the courts in Arizona. But it's ultimately up to the court to decide, but as I would expect there to be a full hearing on all the preliminary injunction motions before July 29th.
Great. Professor Chin, anything to add on that?
No, not really.
Okay. Operator, do we have any more questions?
No, ma'am. There are no further questions.
All right, wonderful. With that, we will wrap up. I want to thank all the participants and the speakers. And if you have any questions or you need to get in touch with any of the speakers, please reach out to the contact on the press advisory, and we will connect you up. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful afternoon.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect. Presenters, please hold your line.
Thank you.
Thank you.